this caravan. Do you understand me?
I do. I'll take two of the hunters. They're the best horses we've got.
Jennatar saddled one horse and put the other on a lead rope, then held the bridle as Jill swung herself up. As she bent over to take the lead rope, their eyes met.
I'll see you on the morrow, Jennatar said.
I'll pray that's true.
Oh, we've got a trick or two to play on these piss-pot bandits. We'll hold them off.
All at once, Jennatar flung his hands over his head and danced, just a few quick steps to some unsung music, and he was grinning like a fiend. Seeing him so battle-eager was one of the strangest things on this strange day. Getting the caravan on the road seemed to take an eternity. Cullen kept on the move, yelling orders as the men got the mules loaded and themselves mounted on the spare horses. During the march, he rode up and down the line, yelling and bullying everyone to ride as fast as they could, occasionally slapping the rump of a bulky mule with the flat of his sword to keep it trotting. At last they came to the ruined dun, rising from the wild grass with all the loneliness of a cairn marking a warrior's grave. Although the stone walls and the broch itself looked sound, the wooden gates and outbuildings had long since rotted away. Weeds and ivy ran riot in the ward. Cullen herded the caravan inside.
Get the mules and horses inside the broch. Feed them to keep them calm.
When he saw his orders being followed, he ran round to the back of the ward and found the well. As he'd expected, it had fallen in and was choked with rubble as well as ivy. He ran back into the broch and detailed three muleteers to rush to the nearby stream and fill every pot and water skin they had. After one side, he saw Aderyn testing the rusty spiral staircase that led up to the second floor.
It should hold my weight, Aderyn announced. I wouldn't let a man of your size try it. I doubt me if the floor above will hold anyone.
Cullen glanced up at the rotten timbers.
I have to try. I need a high place that's also private. I can't be scaring the men out of their wits with Dweilmer.
Cullen felt a bit queasy himself.
Jill said Lovelane is a lord's counsellor, Aderyn went on. Could he persuade his lord to send men to murder us?
It depends on how much this Corbin honours him, I suppose, but it's hard to believe.
Do you think Lovelane's trying to stop you from hauling him in for that murder? That was my first thought, but it doesn't make sense. Yet I've never seen bandits out here, and I tell you, the men I saw were cursed well-armed. Well, I'll have another look.
As nimbly as a squirrel, Aderyn scrambled up the creaking stairs. Cullen hurried outside and saw the Westfolk down by the gate. They were unpacking gear from the travois, a pair of longbows, beautifully polished staves of some dark wood he'd never seen before, and as tall as they were.
Archers, are you?
We are, Jennatar said. I think me our bandits are in for a little surprise.
He gestured at Abarl, who was unpacking a sword belt.
He is not Cullen of Caermore, but we fight with long knives in our land, too.
Well and good, then. Maybe we'll take some of these bandits to the other lands with us. Albarl, do you have any armor?
Eldith mail. Thought it might come in handy, so I packed it.
And here I thought you were a fool, Calondariel said, for dragging all that weight along.
Albarl smiled with a tight twist to his mouth. Cullen noticed that Albarl had a scar down his cheek, much like the one he himself carried.
So, your people fight among themselves, do they?
Every now and then. But an Eldith lord marked me like this. I killed the bastard for it, long time ago now.
The four of them peered up at the rotted splinters along the top of the wall that were all that was left of the catwalks under the ramparts. Never would they hold an archer again.
Well, the top of that wall's about 5 feet thick, Jennatar said at last. We can stand there and shoot if we're careful. Those projection things will provide some cover for our legs anyway.
Merlons.
With a real surprise, Cullen realized that they knew nothing about duns.
They're called merlons, but we still have to get you up there.
Albarl took a rope off the travois, turned it into a lasso, then stepped back and cast. The loop sailed up and encircled a merlon as easily as if he'd been aiming at a horse in a herd. Cullen whistled in admiration.
Now we can weave ourselves a ladder,
Calondariel said. I wonder if those bandits are still lying in their stinking ambush.
May the flies cluster thick around them if they are.
Adarin will know, Genitar said.
Or look, he's just going to find out.
Just then Cullen heard a strange sound above him, a rushy flap like the wings of an enormous bird. When he glanced up, an enormous bird was exactly what he saw, a great silver owl, a good 5 feet long, flapping up from the broch, circling once, then heading off to the east with a long, mournful cry. Albarol waved farewell to it as casually as if he were waving to some friend who was riding off to a tavern. For a moment, Cullen came close to vomiting.
By the black ass of the Lord of Hell! Can Adarin turn himself into an owl?
Of course, Genitar said. You just saw him, didn't you?
Cullen's mind refused to acknowledge the fact. He had, of course, seen the owl. He believed that Genitar was telling the truth. He even remembered seeing Adarin go upstairs for some purpose of his own. But his mind stubbornly refused to draw the proper conclusion. He stared at the sky for a long time before he could speak.
Well and good, then. Albarol, we'd best get our cursed mail on our backs.
Every morning, unless it was pouring rain, Hrodri led his warband out to exercise the horses. Lately, thanks to the threat of rebellion, he'd been making the rides good long ones to ensure that men and mounts both would be fit to ride to war. Thus it seemed perfectly logical when the idea occurred to him of taking the men out for a day-long jaunt. He was talking with Cairnrith, his captain, as he usually did after breakfast, when suddenly, out of nowhere as he would later realize, it occurred to him that none of them had spent a full day in mail in months.
"Have the men pack provisions for the noon meal. We'll ride fully armed, rest a bit, and then return."
"Well and good, my lord. Which way shall we ride?"
"Oh, it doesn't much matter." Rodri named the first direction that came to mind. "West."
Although a dark line of fog crouched ominously on the ocean horizon, it was a fine sunny morning when they set out. Every now and then, Rodri would turn in the saddle just to look at his men, riding two abreast with the red lion shield of his adopted clan at every saddle peak. Soon he would be leading a full army.
"Cavradoc," he thought to himself. "It has a fine ring to it, truly."
Eventually he called Cairnrith up to ride beside him. The captain was a solid man in his late 20s with blonde hair and a drooping moustache almost as thick as Sliggins. Since he'd served the Clu Coq all his life, Rodri could speak freely with him.
"Are the men talking of Dwayomer among themselves?"
"They are, my lord. I do my best to stop it."
"I knew I could count on you for that. How do you feel about these rumours yourself?"
"Pile of horseshit, my lord."
"Good. I couldn't agree more."
At noon they stopped to rest in a meadow about half a mile inland where a river wound down from the north. Just like one of his men, Rodri unsaddled his own horse and let it roll, then tethered it out. He sat on the grass with his men, too. He knew that they saw him as an interloper, and he was determined to show them that the sudden elevation of his prospects in life hadn't swelled his head. They were all trading friendly jests over their bread and smoked meat, when Rodri felt as much as heard hoofbeats coming their way. He scrambled up and looked off to the north. Trotting fast beside the river came a rider leading a spare horse.
"Who by the gods would be out here?"
Cairnrith joined him and shaded his eyes to stare at the tiny figures.
"Old Nevin the herdman, maybe,"
Cairnrith said.
"It's not, because those are two western hunters, not a palfrey and a mule."
"By the hells, his lordship has cursed good eyes."
"So I do."
Rodri saw a wink of silver at the rider's belt. "A silver dagger with two western hunters. What do we have here, a horse thief?" No horse thief, however, would have broken into a gallop and ridden straight for them as the silver dagger did. He was a young lad, blonde and road-filthy, and riding without a shield, though he had a sword at his side. He swung himself down from his horse and ran to kneel at Rodri's feet. Down one side of his face was a livid purple bruise.
"My lord!"
His soft, unchanged voice made it likely he was about 14.
"Do you serve the Tyrin in Cannobane?"
"I do, and I'm her son to boot, Lord Rodri Maelwyth."
"A Maelwyth? Thanks be to every god. Then I know I can trust your honour, my lord. I've just come from a merchant caravan to beg for help." It's bandits, my lord, at least 30 of them, and they've got us penned up in a ruined dun to the north.
Bandits? In my domain? I'll have their heads on pikes.
Rodri spun around to yell orders.
Saddle up and get ready to ride. Amir, ride back to the dun and give her grace the news. Tell her to send a cart with supplies and the chirurgeon after us.
Everyone ran to do his bidding.
Get up, Silver Dagger, Rodri said. What were you, a hired guard?
Well, my father is, to tell you the truth. I just travel with him.
Well, mount up and get ready to lead us back.
What a splendid bit of luck this is, me having the warband out here. You'd think it was Dwayomer or such like. The lad giggled in an outburst of hysteria, then ran back to his horses. As the hot afternoon dragged on, there was no sign of a Derrin. While the others rested inside the Groch, Cullen and Jennatar kept an uneasy watch, Cullen at the gates, Jennatar pacing back and forth along the top of the wall. Cullen began to wonder if they'd ever see the old man again, or if he'd been captured by the enemy. Finally, when the sun lay low in the sky, Jennatar called out in triumph.
"Here he comes!"
Although Cullen strained his eyes, it was several minutes more before he saw the flapping speck in the sky that meant the owl. All over again, Cullen felt sick at the unnatural size of the thing, as the bird swooped down and disappeared into an upper window of the Broch. It was some minutes before a Derrin ran out, pulling his tunic over his head.
"They're on their way, but so is help. Lord Rodri and his warband are heading up from the south."
"What did Jill do?" Cullen said. "Found her both those horses?"
"She didn't. She met Rodri on the road."
A Derrin looked briefly troubled.
"Something stranger than strange is afoot here. Jennatar, did you see any hawks fly overhead?"
"One or two," Jennatar called down. "Oh, ye gods, you don't think—"
"I do. Lovelane has to be behind this."
A Derrin turned to Cullen.
"The men I saw were well-armed, well-provisioned, and they carried shields with a number of different blazons."
"Then they're not bandits, sure enough. What's Lovelane trying to do? Kill the witnesses to his murder before they reach the court?"
"So I thought at first, but here, I am the chief witness against him, and it's hard to trap a man who can fly away."
The old man allowed himself the ghost of a smile. The rest of the men were already running out of the Broch. Hurriedly, Cullen disposed the pitiful force he had on hand. 2 decent swordsmen, counting himself, 3 men skilled with a quarterstaff, and 5 who knew the right way to hold the staff and little more. Because of the rubble, the gate was only big enough for 2 men to fight side by side. He and Obarl would have to hold it as long as they could, with Dregeth and the other skilled stavemen right behind to step in when they fell. Up on the wall, the archers stood ready with full quivers at their hips. A Derrin climbed up to join them.
"Now listen, lads," Cullen said. "No heroics like in the bard songs. Just fight to hold your place."
It was some time before Cullen saw the pack of 34 men in mail ride out of the east at a steady trot. About 300 yards away, they drew up and clustered around a leader for a hasty conference, then came on again at a walk. Cullen could see men loosening shields and getting ready to dismount for the final charge on the gates, but like most Eldith men, they were going to stay in the saddle for as long as possible, a habit that was to prove fatal. At 100 yards, they pulled up, well out of javelin range. Arrows sang out from the wall, then again and again. The lead horses reared, screaming in agony, and went down hard, rolling on their riders, as the arrows came again and again and again. Horses behind them bucked and kicked in panic. Men yelled and cursed. The arrows flew again, a noiseless rain of death. The warband broke into a riot of men on foot and panicked horses, and still the arrows flew down. Shouting, screaming, the warband turned tail and fled, leaving behind 12 dead men and more horses. Far down in the meadow, they regrouped. When the muleteers broke into howls of laughter, Cullen turned and yelled them into silence.
"It isn't over yet," Cullen said. "We don't have all the arrows in the world with us, and even if 10 of those bastards reach the gate, you'll need your wits about you. If you dogs even have any."
Then came more waiting.
While the sun inched itself another notch lower in the sky, their enemies argued, and somewhere, or so Cullen devoutly hoped, Lord Rodri and his men were riding nearer. Finally, Cullen saw the enemy dismounting. They spread out into two squads, each circling out of bowshot range around a different side of the dun, then splitting up again. Jennatar muttered something in his own tongue that had to be a vile oath from its tone.
"They've learned summat," O'Barrow remarked.
"So they have," Cullen said. "The only thing they can do, rush us from all sides and circle under the shelter of the walls."
"We can't stop them with only two archers."
They exchanged a grim smile. At that moment, Cullen wondered how he could have hated the West folk. He and O'Barrow understood each other perfectly well. Most of the enemy were moving round to the back of the dun. Jennatar began sidling along the wall to meet them, but Calandariel held his post over the gates until the other squad began moving to the side. Cursing under his breath, Calandariel moved to face them. For a moment, everything was preternaturally quiet. Then a silver horn rang out. Distantly, from the far side of the Broch, war cries exploded as the charge began. Closer and closer, a few screams as arrows hit their mark, then the jingle and clink of men in mail running. The first enemies rounded the wall and raced for the gates. Three, four, too many to count, they mobbed in, but the gate was too narrow for mobs. The fight was a shoving match as much as it was sword work. Cullen parried more than he swung, using his shield like a bludgeon to shove back the blades that hit it. Screaming war cries, the men at the rear pressed forward and forced their own men at the front off balance. Cullen and O'Barrow swung and parried and swayed back and forth in a perfect rhythm with each other. Arrows flew down into the rear of the mob, and Cullen saw one shaft split a lad's mail and skewer him like a chicken on a spit. Cursing and yelling, part of the mob tried to peel off and run back around the walls. The rest surged forward. Cullen got a kill at last, keeping his arm close to his side and stabbing rather than slashing. As the corpse fell, it knocked another man off his feet, and the mob swirled in confusion. Over the screaming, Cullen heard a silver horn ring out.
"Red Lions!"
Calandariel yelled.
"Caliban!"
Dregith howled. Trapped between Lord Rodri's charge and the dun, the enemy broke in screaming panic. One clot of men surged blindly forward. Cullen saw O'Barrow knocked off balance and swung round toward him. With a shout, Dregith leapt into line. Out of the corner of his eye, Cullen saw the blur of a staff swinging down and the snap of a head as an enemy fell. An enemy slashed at O'Barrow, but an arrow caught him in the back. With a quick stab and slash, Cullen killed the last of them. He threw his shield and grabbed O'Barrow's arm as he tried to stagger to his feet. O'Barrow flopped like a rag doll onto Cullen's shoulder, and his mouth and nose were running blood. The cat-slit eyes, no longer alien somehow, sought his.
"I always knew this dun would see my death," O'Barrow said. "Never thought I'd be defending it."
When he coughed, blood bubbled and gouted on his lips. Staggering under his weight, Cullen knelt to lay him back down, but O'Barrow was dead before they reached the ground, his mouth frozen in a blood-stained smile at his own jest.
"Ah, shit!" Cullen said.
Around him echoed the cheers of the muleteers. Cullen closed O'Barrow's eyes, crossed his arms over his chest, then rose to find himself face to face with Rodri. For a moment they merely looked at each other. Cullen was sure that he knew him. Irrational though it was, he'd never been so sure of anything in his life, that he knew this young lord like a brother. Then the feeling vanished, like Dweoma. Rodri laid a sympathetic hand on his shoulder.
"News a friend," Rodri said. "I did. Well, it happens." "So it does, Silver Dagger."
Cullen nodded and let out his breath in a long sigh, surprised at the truth of it. O'Barrow had become a friend, there in the breach. The other two Westfolk came running. At the sight of O'Barrow, Jennatar burst out keening and flung himself down by the body, but Calandariel merely set his hands on his hips, his whole body as tense as a strung bow.
"There's another one," he whispered, "slayed by the stinking round-ears."
Then he looked up and howled out a single word in his own tongue, the meaning plain for any man to hear. Vengeance. Cullen and Rodri glanced at each other, then walked away to leave the Westfolk to their mourning. Once they were out of earshot, the puzzled lord turned to Cullen.
"Westfolk? What are Westfolk doing mixed up in this?"
"It's a stinking strange tale all round, my lord. These men weren't bandits either. What would you say if I told you Councillor Lovelane of Dunbrothlin's behind this?"
Rodri seemed about to argue, then he glanced down to see the shattered shield of one of the enemy, a green shield with a tan chevron.
"By the Lord of Hell's hairy balls, that's Corbin's blazon, sure enough. Looking for a higher silver dagger? I think me you've already captained the first battle of an open war."
Levian was wondering irritably when Rodri and his warband would return, when Amir rode in to deliver Rodri's message. Although she said nothing to Amir, the news troubled her badly. She knew that there weren't any bandits in Western Eldith, for the simple reason that there wasn't enough caravan trade to support them. At dinner, she and her two serving women, Danyan and Medela, sat at table in a hall eerily silent with the warband gone. Levian picked at her food, then decided she wasn't in the least hungry.
"My lady's sore troubled," Medela said.
"I am. It was stupid of Rodri to ride off into nowhere like that." They nodded their agreement. Dark-haired and delicate Danyan, blonde and homely Medela, were both in their late 30s, noble-born friends rather than servants, who 20 years ago had chosen to take Levian's service rather than marry the unsuitable men their fathers had picked out for them. Shrewd women both, they were her counsellors, and Levian knew that no matter how much intrigue might rage around a powerful court, she could count on both for absolute honesty.
"I rather find myself missing Tinga tonight. It's so rare that I do. But as a husband he had his good points."
"He understood matters of war, truly," Danyan said.
"So, Dan, you don't think these so-called bandits are real bandits?"
"I don't. I was wondering if we should send a message to Sligin."
"That's a very good idea. We can send one of the stable lads. The young rider who just came back must be dead tired."
Levian was about to call Caradoc when she heard a clatter in the ward, men and horses riding in, and servants shouting as they ran to meet them. Half thinking it might be Hrodri, Levian rose from her chair, but it was Sligin who strode into the great hall, and right behind him came Nevin.
"Well, fancy that," Levian said. "My lord, I was just going to send you a message."
"No doubt, your grace."
Sligin bent his knee in a bob that passed for a kneel.
"Our good herdman here has been telling me that Hrodri went off like a madman to chase bandits. Bandits? Ha!"
"I just happened to see them on the road, your grace," Nevin said. "I was gathering valerian root out in the wilderness."
"Could have been cow dung for all I care," Sligin snorted. "What counts is that you had the wits to ride straight to me. Your grace, I've had troubling news beyond what our Nevin tells me."
Levian realized that armed men were filling the hall. 20, 30, close to 40, most of Sligin's warband.
"Danyan, send a servant to fetch those men ale," Levian said. "Nevin, come have mead with us. I think me you've earned it."
Once they were settled, Sligin told his tale. Not 20 minutes after Nevin came in with his news, a messenger arrived from Lord Eddar, whose domain was in the north close to Corbin's, to announce that Corbin and his allies had mustered their army. Eddar himself was sending his wife and children to shelter with her brother in the east, and he and his warband would be joining Sligin in Cannobane.
"He'll arrive in 2 days. The messenger was going to ride on to you, but I decided to take the news on myself. I took the liberty of sending it along to the rest of your loyal men. Thought we didn't have any time to waste."
"My thanks," Levian said. "I'm afraid I don't have the men to ride messages anyway."
"So Nevin told me, and a grim thing that is, eh? Here, your grace, if an army had turned up at your gate, how long could you and the servants have held Duncannabane?"
"Long enough for you to relieve us, my lord. But I'm glad I don't have to put that boast to the test."
"Just so."
Sligin had a thoughtful sip of mead.
"Well, the rest of your allies should ride in on the morrow. I told them to ride at night if they had to. We'll leave you a good fort guard before we go."
"Will you ride north after Corbin?"
"West, my lady. Rodri's out in the wilderness with, what, 50 men and whatever excuses for guards that merchant had.
Corbin's mustered at least 200 men, and I'll wager he's on his way west right now.
Levian bit her lip to keep from crying out.
Don't distress yourself unduly, Your Grace, Nevin broke in. Later, I'll have a few interesting things to tell you.
My lord, Adarin said, I know you have no reason to believe me, but I swear I'm telling the truth.
Rodri felt like grabbing the man by the shoulders and shaking him. For an hour now, he'd listened to so much talk of Dwayoma that he felt as if the strange words and stranger tales were water that would physically drown him. He turned to Cullen, sitting beside him at the campfire in the ward. In the dancing firelight, the silver dagger's impassive face was unreadable.
I'd believe him, my lord, Cullen said. Didn't he tell us about the ambush? For that matter, didn't he tell us that you were on the way? True enough. Well and good, then, Adarin. If you say that Sligan's coming with an army, then we'll stay here and wait for him.
My thanks, my lord. If I might make a suggestion, on the morrow you might want to have some of your men cut down trees to barricade that gap in the walls. Dregeth has some axes left from his trading.
Good idea, Rodri said. By the black hairy ass of the Lord of Hell, I feel like such a dolt.
His lordship is nothing of the sort, Adarin snapped. That trap was very well laid, and you had no way of knowing that Lovelane was using Dwayoma to put thoughts into your mind. It's just a very good thing that Lovelane had no way of knowing about Nevin.
Rodri shuddered profoundly.
But there's one small thing I don't understand, Adarin went on. Why didn't Corbin have his whole army out here to wait for you?
Simple, Cullen broke in. If he'd marched west with his full force, every lord in the north would have seen him, and they would have mustered and followed him straight away. But he and his allies could slip a few men out, a couple at a time, no doubt, and then follow with the rest. If his worm-riddled plan had worked, he would have been a full day's march ahead of Rodri's allies. Oh, they'd have caught us on the road, sure enough. They might catch us here instead, Rodri said. Adarin, do you know how close Corbin is?
I don't, but if his lordship will excuse me, I intend to find out.
For a while, Rodri and Cullen sat together in a companionable silence and watched the leaping fire. All around them the men slept, rolled up in their blankets. For all that Cullen was a dishonored silver dagger, Rodri found his presence comforting. Here at least was a man he could understand.
It's passing strange. I've heard of your glory, of course, and I've always wanted to meet you, but I was thinking it might be under better circumstances than this. Oh, I don't know, my lord. I couldn't think of a better time for you to ride my way.
Rodri laughed.
True enough. If the caravan hadn't sent a messenger to me, I suppose Lovelane would have sent one of his men, claiming to be a guard or such like. You just spared him the trouble by sending your lad. My lad?
Cullen gave him a grin.
Here, my lord, Jill's my daughter. Oh, ye gods! Here I rode with her all day, and I never once thought she was a lass.
Sometime later, Jill came to sit with her father. She'd apparently washed her face and hair in the stream, because the dirt was gone, revealing a face that was not only obviously female, but beautiful. Or at least it would be beautiful if it weren't for the black and blue bruise on her face.
Where did you get that bruise?
Cullen said to her.
You gave it to me this morning.
Cullen winced.
Well, so I did. Forgive me, my sweet. I was half to pieces thinking you'd be slain.
Jill turned to Cullen and gave him a smile that turned her beauty as delicate and glowing as that of any court lady. Rodri's heart sank. It was more than unfair of the gods to give a lass like this a father who happened to be the best swordsman in the whole wide kingdom of Deveri. All morning the Tyran's loyal men mustered at Duncanabane. Following Sligan's orders, they'd ridden fast, leaving their provision carts to follow at their own slow pace, under the guard of the common-born spearmen that their various towns owed them in time of war. Nevin sat off to one side of the great hall and kept an eye on Levian as she greeted first Lord Oleth, then Peridir, then Daumir, and finally Maneth, who was the captain of the warband stationed at Dungwerbin. At last, over 200 men were crowded into the great hall. Levian was taking the strain well, greeting each leader calmly. The only emotion she allowed herself was the occasional outburst of wrath at the rebel Corbin, a wrath that was fit for a tyrant. About an hour before noon, Sligan rose to his feet and announced that they had enough men to set out.
"The lads from farther away will ride in tomorrow," Sligan announced to all and sundry. "But we can't wait, eh?"
When the lords nodded their agreement, Nevin could see tension on their faces. Just how many of those vassals would indeed arrive, and how many go over to the rebels? Only the final count of the muster would answer that question. Levian named Sligan Cavredoc until the army should meet up with Rodri, and in a bustle of talk and the jingle of mail, lords and the warbands alike got up and began filing out of the hall. In the confusion, Nevin hurried to Levian's side. She led him back to the hearth for a few private words.
"Does Rodri still live?"
"He does. Aderyn contacted me naught but an hour ago. There's no sign of trouble so far today. With this army coming, it would behoove Corbin to withdraw to safer territory. No doubt Lovelane will advise his lord to do so."
After so many years of hearing him talk of Dwayoma, Levian took this news calmly. Nevin himself, however, was seriously concerned about the depths of the evil into which Lovelane had fallen.
"Which would you rather have me do? Stay with you or ride with the army?"
"Ride, of course, and not just for the sake of my feelings. I keep remembering what you said to me the first time we met, when Rodri had that terrible congestion of the lungs. Rodri's weird is Eldith's weird, you told me."
Levian paused, watching armed men swagger out the door.
"I love Eldith even more than my son. Keep him safe, for her."
Although the army was travelling light, there were pack horses in the rear carrying a few days' provision to tide it over until the carts caught up. Since, as far as anyone knew, Nevin was a herdman and nothing more, he rode in the rear as well, with his pack mule behind him. Up at the head of the line, Sligan set a fast pace, alternately walking and trotting. Although with their late start they would never reach Rodri by nightfall, Sligan intended to get to him as early as possible on the morrow. Nevin was glad of the speed for his own private reasons. Aderyn, of course, had told him who was waiting at the ruined dun. Soon, if all went well, just on the morrow, he would at last see his Bronwyn again.
"I wish we could cremate him,"
Jennatar said in a thin, flat voice.
"But there's no wood, and no sacred oil."
"A grave will do," Calendariel said. "He's dead, my friend. It won't matter one cursed jot to him what we do with his flesh."
Jennatar nodded in miserable agreement and went on digging Elbaril's grave. Jill kept an eye on him as the two men of the Westfolk worked, sweating in the hot sun as the narrow trench grew deeper and deeper. The night before, Jennatar had been so hysterical with grief that Aderyn had given him a strong draught of sleeping potion. Now he seemed merely light-headed and a little sick, like a man who had drunk too much mead the night before. At last, they were done. They threw the shovels to one side, then picked up Olbarrel's body, wrapped in a blanket, and laid him in. For a moment, all three of them stood in respectful silence for the dead. All at once, Jennatar tossed back his head and howled with rage. Before either Jill or Calendariel could stop him, he drew his knife and made a shallow gash on his forearm.
"Vengeance!" he screamed. "I'll have blood to match mine for this!"
Jennatar held his arm over the grave and let the blood drip, splattering the blanket.
"I witness your vow," Calendariel said softly.
Jennatar nodded and let the blood run. Suddenly Jill saw, or thought she saw, Elbaril's shade, a pale blue flickering form, something just barely visible in the sunlight. She was afraid she would choke, afraid she was going daft. Jennatar howled out a wordless cry, then ran blindly away, crashing into a thicket of trees far downstream. The shade, if indeed it had ever been there, was gone.
"We'd best leave him alone with his grief," Calendariel said. "I'll fill this in."
"I'll help."
Jill took a shovel gladly. She wanted to forget what she might have just seen. When they were finished, they went back to the dun and found an open spot by the back wall where Calendariel could work at straightening the arrows he'd salvaged from the battlefield. The Westfolk had a special tool for that, the shoulder blade of a deer pierced with a hole just the diameter of a shaft.
"We didn't bring a lot of arrows with us," he remarked. "I never dreamt we'd be riding into the middle of a war. Are there any good Fletchers in this part of the world?"
"I wouldn't know. I've never shot a bow myself."
Calendario frowned down at the mangled fletching on the arrow in his hands. His eyes were a deep purple, as rich and dark as Bardic velvet.
"I might as well cut them off. Curse it, I've left the proper knife in my gear.
Borrow this."
Jill drew her silver dagger.
"It's about as sharp as you'll find."
He whistled under his breath and took the dagger from her. When he ran one finger down the flat of the blade, the weapon glowed with a light strong enough to be visible even in the daylight.
"Dwarven silver," he said. "You don't see a lot of this around, do you?"
"What did you call it?"
"Dwarven silver. Isn't that what it is? Where did you get this, anyway?"
"From a smith named Otho on the very border."
"And this Otho was a short man."
He gave her a sly grin, "but stocky for all his lack of height."
"He was. Don't tell me you know him."
"Not him, truly, but his people."
Jill was too puzzled by the way her dagger was behaving to wonder about Otho's clan. She took it and turned it this way and that, to watch the light playing on the surface. In her hands it was much dimmer.
"I've never seen it glow like this."
"It's because of me. Otho's folks don't care for the likes of me. They like to know when one of us is around, because they think we're a pack of thieves."
Jill looked up sharply.
"Elki and Laka," she whispered. "Elves."
"Call us what you like," he said with a laugh. "But we've been given those names before, true enough."
One at a time, like slow raindrops falling into a still pond, wild folk manifested around him. A blue sprite, two warty gnomes, the thick shimmer of air that meant a sylph, as if they were hounds, come to lie at their master's feet.
"And what's the true name of your people, then?"
"Oh, now, that's summat I'll never tell you. You have to earn the right to hear that name, and of all your folks, Aderin's the only one who has."
Calendario smiled, taking any insult from his words.
"Now, I've heard some of the tales you folk tell about us. We're not thieves, and we're not demons from hell or closer to the gods than you are, either, but simple flesh and blood like you. Old Aderin tells me that our gods fashioned us from the wild folk, just like your gods fashioned you from animals, and so here we are, together on the earth for good or ill."
"Here, our priests say the gods made us from earth and water."
"The Tuayomer knows a fair bit more than the priests. Remember that well. May I have the borrowing of that dagger again? I've got a wretched lot of work to do."
Jill handed it back. For a long time she sat and watched it glow like fire in his hands, while she wondered over the strange things he'd told her. Toward noon, Jill saw the great silver owl circle the brook and disappear inside, a sight that made her shudder. She ran after it, and found Cullen and Rodri talking together at the foot of the stairs. In a few minutes, Aderin came down, swinging his arms and flexing his shoulders like a man who'd just swum a very long way in a strong sea.
"I found them, my lord. They're staying in a camp about 15 miles to the northeast."
"Well and good, then," Rodri said. "We might as well ride out and meet Sliggan."
"That might be unwise, my lord," Cullen broke in. "They won't risk besieging the Dun with an army coming at their back, but they might make a desperate ride to catch you if you were out in the open."
"And how will they know if we—" "Oh, by every god and his wife, what a dolt I am. Of course they'll know."
"You know, Silver Dagger," Aderin went on, "I'd take it most kindly if you stuck close to Lord Rodri when things come to battle. If the rebels are going to succeed, they have to kill him before they've caused so much damage that Gwerbret Rhys is forced to intervene. No doubt that's why they're not attacking Sliggan's army. They can't risk killing the noble-born unless Rodri's there as a possible prize."
"Just that," Cullen said. "Here, I thought you said you didn't understand matters of war. Sounds to me like you were being modest."
"Oh, I'm just repeating what Nevin told me."
Rodri and Cullen nodded thoughtfully at this meaningless remark.
"Aderin, I don't understand," Jill broke in. "You say that no one told you."
"Oh,"
the old man chuckled under his breath,
"My apologies, child. I have a friend named Nevin. His father gave him the name as some kind of bitter jest, if I remember rightly."
Since Otho the Smith was very much on her mind, Jill suddenly remembered his riddle, that some day no one would tell her what craft to follow. If he were a friend of Adarin's, this no one had to be a Dwayoma man too. While the men went on talking of the coming war, Jill slipped away and ran out of the dun. By the stream that ran behind it, she sat down and watched the water sparkling with wild folk, who raised themselves up like waves to greet her. For a moment she couldn't breathe. The Dwayoma seemed to have swooped out of the sky like a falcon, and it had her in its claws. The waiting got on everyone's nerves as the hot summer day dragged on. With nothing but stream water to drink and meagre stale provisions from Dregeth's stores to eat, the warband was in a sullen mood, while the merchant and his muleteers crept around in numb panic. Everywhere Rodri walked, he heard the men talking of Dwayoma, and he could no longer cheerily dismiss their fears. Finally, he went down to the gates, newly barricaded with big logs, and found Cullen there, leaning meditatively against the barricade on folded arms and watching the ravens wheel over the dead horses out in the meadow. Rodri joined him.
"At least old Dregeth had shovels with him. Enemies or not, it would have ached my heart to leave those men unburied." "That's most honourable of you, my lord." It's but my duty. I've been thinking about what old Adarin asked you, about sticking close to me in the scraps, I mean. They're going to be riding to mob me, sure enough, and I'd never ask a man to put himself in that kind of danger. Ride where you will on the field." "Then I'll ride next to you."
When Rodri swung around to look at him, Cullen gave him an easy smile.
"My weird will come when it comes," Cullen said. "It gripes my heart to think of a decent man like you being killed for a handful of coin. What are these lords, silver daggers?"
"Well, my thanks, truly my thanks. I'm honoured that a man like you would think so highly of me."
"A man like me, my lord?"
Cullen touched the hilt of his silver dagger as if to remind Rodri of his shame.
"Ah, by the hells, what do I care what you did 20 years ago or whenever it was? You've ridden through more rough scraps than a lord like me ever even hears about."
"Well, maybe, my lord, but I..."
In the ward behind them, yells exploded, jeers and curses and ill-natured taunts from the warband. Over it all, like the shriek of a raven, floated Jill's voice, shrill with rage.
"Oh, ye gods!"
Cullen turned on his heel and ran. Rodri was right behind him. As they came round the side of the broch, they saw half the warband gathered round Jill, who yelled foul insults back as fast as they yelled them at her. Cainrith came running from the other direction and elbowed himself into the mob, pulling or slapping his men away impartially, like a hunter slapping the dogs off the kill.
"Now what's all this, you young swine?"
Cainrith snarled.
"I'll put stripes on your back if you've been doing the wrong things to this lass."
"It isn't that at all."
Jill was shaking in fury.
"They've been saying I don't have the right to carry this sword. Just let one of the little bastards try to take it away from me."
When the warband surged forward, Rodri shoved his way through the pack, which fell back at the sight of him.
"My apologies, fair maid." Rodri made her a bow.
"I don't want any cursed apology,"
Jill snarled, adding a "my lord" as an afterthought.
"I meant what I said. Just let one of them try to take it away. A challenge, I mean. Come on, you bastards. I'll take any one of you on with my bare hands, if you have the balls to face me."
Rodri was struck speechless. When he turned to Cullen, he found the silver dagger his usual impassive self.
"My lord, over the years I've learnt it's best to let Jill settle these things her own way."
"What?" Rodri and Cainrith spoke together.
"She'll get hurt." "If I thought that," Cullen said levelly, "I'd have my sword out and swinging right now. I've seen this kind of scrap 100 times, my lord, and I'll wager Jill wins handily."
"Done then," Rodri said. "One silver piece gets you 2 if your lass wins."
Shaking his head in bewilderment, Cainrith set up a fair fight between Jill and Praith, a beefy man who was the best brawler in the warband. Praith was grinning at the easy fight ahead as he handed his sword belt over to Cainrith. By then, every man in the dun was crowded round the contest ground. Rodri noticed Adarin, watching in horrified alarm, and the two men of the Westfolk who were making wagers on Jill against any man who'd take them on.
"Very well, then," Kenrith said, stepping clear. "It's on."
Jill and Praith began to circle around each other, hands raised and ready. Praith charged, swinging confidently, only to find Jill dodging in from the side. She grabbed his wrist as he punched, dropped to one knee, and somehow, just like Dwayoma, 200-pound Praith flew through the air and landed with a grunt amid the weeds. Still game, he scrambled back up, but this time he moved in cautiously. They feinted, dodged. Praith swung in low from the side. Jill leapt straight up, kicked him in the stomach, and twisted down like a dancing girl. Gasping, Praith doubled over, then forced himself upright. Jill danced in and clipped him neatly and precisely on the chin. With a sigh, Praith closed his eyes and fell forward on the ground. The Westfolk yelled in triumph, and Cullen laughed softly under his breath. But the warband was utterly silent, staring at Jill in disbelief, and sideways at Rodri in shame. Jill set her hands on her hips and glared at them.
"Anyone else?"
"Jill, enough!" Cullen called out. "You've made your cursed point, and I have to ride with them."
"True spoken," Rodri said, stepping forward. "All right, men, go pour water over your sleeping comrade there, and don't feel shamed on my account. I've just lost a good bit of silver myself."
Still, they must have felt the dishonour at the hands of a lass, because they frankly fled, stopping only long enough to scoop up Praith and carry him away, with the Westfolk trailing after to make sure they collected their coppers. Rodri made Jill a bow.
"And where did you learn to fight like that?"
"Dar taught me summat, my lord, and I figured the rest out for myself."
Jill wiped the sweat off her face onto her shirt sleeve like a man, but still, Rodri's heart skipped a beat. He'd never seen a lass like her, and she was lovely, oh so lovely. Then he realized that Cullen was watching him with grim paternal suspicion.
"I'll get those coins out of my saddlebags for you, and you'd best keep your Hellcat here away from the warband for a while."
"I will, my lord. Have no fear of that."
As Rodri hurried away, he was cursing himself for an utter fool. He knew that he should put this common-born lass with the dangerous father out of his mind for good, but he also knew that for some bizarre reason he was falling in love again. That night, Lord Sligan's army camped on the banks of the stream that would eventually lead them to Rodri. The men gathered in little groups, their campfires like flowers of light out in the dark wild meadow. As Nevin wandered through the camp, he came across a man he knew, Sandir, who rode for Lord Sligan. A year ago, Nevin had pulled a bad tooth for him and cured the infection, and apparently Sandir remembered it kindly.
"It's Nevin! Here, sit down at our fire, good sir. This is our Cass and Evia. Lads, this is the best herdman who ever rode the kingdom."
Sandir's two comrades greeted Nevin with small smiles and nods of their heads.
"I was cursed glad when I saw you in the train," Sandir said. "I'd rather have you along than our Lord Skyrurgeon any day."
"Oh, he's a good man. He just doesn't know teeth the way I do."
"Maybe so."
Sandir rubbed his jaw at the memory of that long-gone abscess. "But let's hope that none of us need your cures after a scrap."
"Or here," Arkath said with a twisted grin. "I don't suppose you have any herbs to protect a man against Dwayoma."
All three laughed uneasily.
"Well, now, there aren't any herbs like that," Nevin said. "I take it you all believe the rumours going around."
"Doesn't every man in the army?" Sandir went on. "But it's not just wild talk. A couple of us have ridden to Corbin's Dun with messages and such like. I've talked to men who saw this Lovelane do things."
"Do things?"
"I saw this myself,"
Eva broke in, and his broad face was pale.
"Back in the spring it was, when our lord was trying to talk Corbin out of rebelling. Lord Sligan sends me to Brothlin with messages, and Corbin treated me well enough, giving me dinner with his men. So there were these big logs laid in fresh on the honour hearth, and Lovelane comes down with Corbin. I swear it, good sir, I saw Lovelane snap his fingers like, and flames sprang up all over the logs, and they were big logs, no kindling or such like."
"And then one of Lord Oleth's men went to Brothlin too,"
Sandir took up the tale.
"He walks in, and Corbin says, 'Well, Lovelane told me you were coming.' The men in his warband swear he knows everything that goes on for miles and miles."
"Makes you wonder what else he can do," Arkath said. Here, Nevin, if you know herbcraft, you must know bones and muscles and such like. Do you think a Dweoma man could turn someone into a frog?
I don't, Nevin said firmly. That's naught but a silly bard's fancy.
Now here, think. All those tales say that the frogs are just ordinary frogs, right? Well, if someone did get turned into a frog, it would have to be a huge one. You can't just go shrinking a man's flesh down to nothing, but the tales never say a thing about frogs big enough to ride.
All three laughed and relaxed at the jest.
Well and good, then, Sandia said. I pledged I'd die for my lord, and I don't give the fart of a two-copper pig if it's Dweoma or a sword that kills me, but cursed if I like the idea of hopping around in a marsh the rest of my days.
The lasses you'd have, Arkath said mournfully, all green and warty. Nevin joined in the general laughter. Jests were the best weapon these men had against the fear preying upon them. Toward midnight, when the camp was asleep except for the night watch, Nevin sat over the dying coals of his fire to contact Aderyn. After their long years of friendship, all he had to do was think of Aderyn briefly before he saw the image of Aderyn's face building up and floating just above the red glow.
There you are, Nevin thought to him. Are you in a position to talk?
I am,
Aderyn thought in return.
The camp's asleep. I was just going to contact you, truly. Corbin's army is still camped where I saw it last. No doubt they're going to wait till we're out of the dun, then make a try at killing Rodri. Is Lovelane still with them?
He is. Ah, ye gods, my heart's half torn apart. What a dolt I was to train the lad.
Nevin bit back the all-too-human temptation to say,
I told you so.
Aderyn's image smiled sourly, as if he knew perfectly well that Nevin was thinking it.
But I did, Aderyn went on, and now his misdoings are my responsibility. You don't have to tell me that twice. What counts now is ending the matter.
Just so. Do you still think he's merely insane?
I do. If he'd truly gone over to the dark path and its foul ways, he'd be hiding himself, not flaunting his gifts and meddling with petty lords.
Now, that's true spoken. Here, you know Lovelane better than I ever will. It seems clear that he's stirred up this blasted rebellion. Why? Is he trying to escape being brought to justice for that murder he did? If so, his scheme won't work.
It doesn't matter who Corbin's overlord is. Gwerbret Rhys would haul him into the Malover as readily as Lavian would.
True spoken, and I've been puzzling myself over this very question. At first I thought he had some scheme of killing me, or at least the other two witnesses I'm bringing. But if that were true, why involve Rodri and half the Tyrinnerin? It doesn't make sense.
It doesn't, and I think me we'd best find out just what he thinks he's up to.
Aderyn laughed, a harsh mutter.
If we can. That's the crux, my friend. If we can.
After he finished talking with Aderyn, Nevin sat up brooding for a long time, hoping that Aderyn was right about Lovelane only being mad. Truly, the lad had been unstable from the beginning. Studying Dweoma demands a perfect stability of mind, a core of simple common sense, in fact, because the forces that Dweoma invokes can tear an unstable mind to pieces, leaving it prey to delusions and fantasies. Lovelane had never had iron in his soul, only the malleable silver of a raw psychic talent that should have been suppressed, not encouraged. At least, if Aderyn was right, Lovelane was only misusing his Dweoma, not immersing himself in strange and unclean things. Just as every light casts a shadow, so does a dark Dweoma exist. The men who study it, and they never open their foul ranks to women, lust after power above all else and hoard it like misers, never helping but only harming other souls. They grub around the dark places of the inner lands for peculiar magics and keep themselves alive unnaturally by feeding on the vitality of spirits and living people alike. Nevin was sworn to destroy such as them wherever he found them, and they knew it and hid from him. Scattered over a wild meadow, the army of Lord Corbin and his allies lay asleep under the starry sky. Sure-footed in the dark, Lovelane picked his way through the camp and out with a muttered word to one of the guards. The stink of so many unwashed humans was making him feel ill, and he walked a good long ways away from camp before he flung himself down in the grass to rest. He was tired. He was always tired these days. Yet when night came, he could not sleep. He pressed both hands against his forehead and tried to steady himself. The despised smell that he'd left behind him seemed to cling to his body and clothes. Suddenly he saw the smell, a thick grey cloud of smoke swirling around him in some unfelt wind. It was only a vision, an illusion, but he had to fight to banish it. Many visions came to him unbidden these days, just odd little things, voices half heard, things half seen, and always he could understand the cause, but still they were terrifying, because he knew that they should never have come at all. A Dwayoma man works long years to open his mind to the inner lands, but at the same time he has to close his mind at will to draw a veil between himself and unseen things. No matter how hard Lovelane tried to close that veil, things slipped through. When he looked up at the stars, they were dancing and leaping, sending long points of light like reflections off a polished blade. Hastily he looked away, but creatures seemed to be crawling through the grass like little weasels, sniffing him out. He flung up one hand and made the banishing sigils in the air. When he looked, the weasel things were gone, and the stars steady. With a sigh that was half a groan, he flung himself face down to lie full length in the grass. The broken light from the stars seemed to dance in his mind, dazzling him. He summoned up an image of darkness, a soft, warm darkness like sleep, and let the image suffuse his mind until at last it seemed to him that he stood inside that warm, comforting dark, safe at last. He'd stumbled upon this trick of summoning a dark some months before. It was the only way he could get any rest. Now it came to him easily, swiftly, every time he called, as if it came of its own will. Yet even wrapped in dark, he could not sleep. His hatred was there in the blackness with him, the hatred he bore toward the stinking human beings he was forced to use as allies, and even more, the hatred he bore toward the Elkian Lakar. It seemed he heard his hatred talking to him in a child's voice, until that voice became his own. There he'd been, practically an outcast in the elven camps, and all because his father was a wretched human being. Oh, everyone had been kind to him. That was the worst wound of all, the galling way that everyone had been ever so kind, as if he were a half-wit who needed tender care. They were smug, the Elkian Lakar, so smug, secure in knowing that they'd live for 400, maybe even 500 years, while as for him, well, how long did a half-breed live anyway? No one truly knew. At any moment he might look in the mirror and see the beginnings of that inevitable human corruption into death that men called old age. He hated them all, men and elves alike. The hatred burned so bright that it threatened to wipe the darkness away. Lovelane steadied himself and thought only of the dark, let it soothe and blanket him. Voices came out of the darkness as they usually did, comforting him, agreeing with him that he'd been ill-used, promising him that he would get his revenge on the Elkian Lakar and Eldith men both. "Lovelane the Mighty," the voices said, "master of the powers of air, no man can touch you, no man can best you, not you, Lovelane the Mighty." "It's true," he answered them in his mind, "I shall have vengeance." "Splendid vengeance for all that these dogs make you suffer." One familiar voice was as soft and smooth as perfumed oil. "Remember, slay Rodri Maelwyth, and all the vengeance you have ever sought will be yours. Rodri must die. Remember, remember." "I remember, and I swear to you I will." He heard a ripple of satisfied laughter, and then the darkness turned thick and warm. At last he could sleep. At dawn on the morrow the camp came awake fast. Lord Sliggan walked through, yelling orders and keeping the men busy until the horses had grazed their fill and everyone was ready to march. All morning they pushed on fast upriver. Nevin felt his excitement at seeing Branwen turn to a curious sort of dread. What was her personality in this life like? What would she think of him? For all his vast age and true Dwayoma, Nevin was man enough to want her to like him. Finally, about an hour before noon, they came to the ruined dun. Rodri and his men were at the gates to greet them with cheers. Since there wasn't enough room in the ward for the army to ride in, the men dismounted outside and sat with their horses while the noble-born went in. Looking for Aderyn, Nevin slipped in too and found him and the two elves waiting for him by the dun wall. Jennatar and Calendariel bowed low.
"Hail, wise one of the East!" Jennatar said. "I'd hoped to meet you again in better circumstances than these."
"I'd been hoping the same thing, truly. It aches my heart that your friend died."